Several years ago, the nation was shocked by news of a gang of Florida teenagers who had murdered three innocent people. Their weapon of choice was not a gun or a knife when they were apprehended. There was no physical evidence of the victims that stained their clothing or connected them in any way to the crime. In fact, they weren't even present when the victims were killed, and yet there was no doubt that they were the ones who were responsible. They intended it as to be nothing more than a prank. They had removed all of the stop signs at a busy four-way intersection, and without that needed piece of instruction, drivers accelerated when they should have been braking. And the result was a fiery crash that eventually took three innocent lives. Today we live in a society where numerous stop signs are being removed. Realms where our culture is telling us that it is permissible for us to proceed when God has told us to stop. Areas that society approves and encourages us to say yes to behavior that God Himself has expressly forbidden. And as a result of removing these stop signs, something results that is even more tragic than the loss of physical life, and that is the condemnation of countless souls. And one of the areas where our culture is the most prominent in terms of taking down the stop signs is in the realm of the sensual. There are some lessons that you thoroughly enjoy preaching. They are uplifting. They are encouraging. And then there are other lessons, such as the lesson tonight, that I feel compelled to preach. I've tried to include it in every session of the marriage lessons that I do. I've tried to make sure that it is a part of the effort, whether it is weekend or throughout the week. Because there is an epidemic of vast proportions that has swept over our nation in the last 50 years. It seemed that years ago, it only affected people within the body of Christ on very rare occasions, but today, it seems all too common that it not only affects members, but those in service and in leadership positions. It touches the lives of preachers and elders and deacons. And what I'm talking about is the dramatic increase in the incidence of marital infidelity. Bombarded by sensual influences that come at us from a number of different directions, it seems that we as a culture have become completely desensitized to sexual sin. Adultery doesn't scare us like it should. News of it certainly doesn't shock us like it used to. A few decades ago, it would mar or jar our moral sensibilities, but today it seems we've come to a place where we almost expect it to occur. And in an attempt to further dull its edge, our society has concocted all kinds of nice little synonyms to describe it, and so we refer to it as an affair, or an indiscretion, or a tryst, or a moral lapse, or a midlife crisis, or we refer to it as sleeping with someone as though some kind of an innocent pajama party has taken place. Tonight, let's leave all of the fancy euphemisms to the world, and let's call it what the Bible calls it. The Bible calls it adultery. The Bible calls it betrayal. The Bible calls it treason. The Bible calls it immorality. The Bible calls it sin. How many of you here tonight could envision yourself, say within the next 5 years, being physically and emotionally involved with someone who is not your mate? I hope the answer to that question is that none of us sees ourselves doing that. And yet, even though none of us would plan on that occurring, it wouldn't be a big surprise, would it, if one or two or three couples that are represented here tonight became involved in that kind of a sin within that stated time frame. That as a result of decisions that they make, they come to find themselves caught in what we might refer to as the Tinder trap. What will help us from becoming a part of the statistic, a part of the epidemic, is gaining a better understanding of certain principles today in the present. And I want us to begin, first of all, by establishing some important background, and that is in terms of the divine design. It seems that when it comes to the Bible and sex, that our culture has a particular idea of what the Bible teaches, and yet in reality, it's not even close to what is found in Scripture. Unfortunately, because of timidity, much more than tact, biblical principles regarding this vital aspect of marriage are either ignored or they are overlooked. And as a result of that, we find ourselves fighting this uphill battle against the world's perception of what they think the Bible teaches that is nothing close to the accurate view. We mustn't be ashamed to discuss what God was not ashamed to create and to discuss openly and frequently within the pages of His Word. There are specific truths about intimacy that have to form the foundation of our understanding. The first one being that sex is not sin. That the very first piece of instruction that's given to the newly formed couple in the book of Genesis chapter 1 involves the physical relationship. Genesis 1 verse 28 and verse 31. As we studied on Friday night, one of the foundational elements is that they became one flesh, that they were naked and not ashamed in Genesis 2 and verses 24 and 25. And yet sin does not enter the human scene until we get to Genesis chapter 3. While it is certainly true that sex can become sinful, it is not true that sex by itself is sin. It is not the invention of a human pervert. It is the product of divine design. Secondly, it was planned for personal pleasure as well. Passages like Deuteronomy 24 and verse 5, Proverbs chapter 5 verses 15 through 20, the book of Song of Songs all indicate that God is not some puritanical prude who designed the physical relationship to be nothing more than a biological necessity to having children. Instead, what it teaches is that there is to be within marriage an exciting passion that works to prevent a search for that passion outside of the marriage relationship. And then the Bible also teaches here in Ephesians chapter 5 and verses 3 and 4 that we are to perceive it as a high and a holy thing. He writes here, "But immorality and any impurity or greed must not even be named among you as is proper among saints, and there must be no filthiness and silly talk or coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather giving of thanks." Those three elements that he names there, immorality, impurity, and greed, encompass virtually every kind of sensual sin that you can imagine. And Paul here doesn't just command us to avoid indulging in those practices, but even talking or thinking about them in a way that would lend approval or tolerance for them. He describes for us the kind of talk that he has in mind with three very specific references. Filthiness is what we would describe in our day as general obscenity. Silly or moronic talk, literally is the idea of the word, would speak of lower obscenity, what we would speak of as gutter language. The term coarse jesting has the idea of turning easily, and what it describes is something that has inundated our culture, and that is innuendo and double entendre. Paul says that the physical relationship, it should not be viewed this way, should not be spoken of this way. Not because we're ashamed of it, not because we're embarrassed by it, but because it is not fitting for those who are making a claim to be saints. He said instead there is to be the giving of thanks. It is to be perceived as a high and holy aspect of life, and therefore it is not to be demeaned or cheapened in any way, but rather honored and preserved by those who claim to belong to Jesus Christ. If you turn over to the book of 1 Thessalonians, a few pages over to the right, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, beginning in verse 3, Paul says that it is to be practiced only within the realm of marriage. He says, verse 3, "For this is the will of God, your sanctification, that you abstain from sexual immorality." 1 Thessalonians 4, now beginning in verse 4. "That each of you know how to possess his own vessel in sanctification and honor, not in lustful passion like the Gentiles who do not know God, and that no man transgress and defraud his brother in the matter, because the Lord is the avenger in all these things, just as we also told you before and solemnly warned you. For God has not called us for the purpose of impurity, but in sanctification. So he who rejects this is not rejecting man, but the God who gives his Holy Spirit to you." Paul, as he closes out, says, look, your argument's not with me. It's not with any man. Your argument in this term, in this realm, is against God himself. The Hebrew writer tells us that marriage is to be held in honor among all, that the bed is undefiled, and he reminds us that fornicators and adulterers that God will judge. It's clear from those passages and a number of others that there is a legitimate sphere in which sex operates, with it, where it is within the will of God, and a number of realms where it is outside of it. That God looks at the physical relationship that He created, and He made it especially for us, but He preserved it for a very special relationship. That it was not a case of God trying to keep us from something good, but rather to preserve us for something even better. Now, if God's Word is so clear on those kinds of points, then how do Christians get themselves into such trouble in these areas? What can you and I do to help prevent ourselves from being caught in the tender trap? And by the way, the points that we're going to look at tonight are just as applicable to those of you who are single and who are trying to remain pure in the sight of God. Five of them. Five flaws that lead to failure, and then we'll wrap up not just tonight's lesson, but our weekend of study as well. Let's begin at the beginning. And to understand that we cannot afford to be blind to our vulnerabilities. That rather than pointing fingers of disgust at other people, we need to realize that sexual sin is something that can happen to virtually any single one of us. That Satan is already halfway there if he can convince us that somehow we are above that kind of sin. Because when you begin to say to yourself, "That'll never happen to me," there is an accompanying belief that you no longer need to be on your guard. You no longer need to be on the alert to the warning signs. King David is described for us as a man after God's own heart. And yet he surrendered to temptation in this very area. Tonight, do you believe that you are spiritually stronger than what David was? And though his was a spiritual treason, you remember that the Apostle Peter was absolutely convinced, in spite of the Lord's prediction to the contrary, that he could ever do anything as heinous as deny Jesus Christ. And yet that was exactly what he did. Matthew 26 and verse 33 and following. The first step to avoiding a head-on collision with infidelity is to acknowledge the fact that you and I are capable of committing almost any kind of sin. Giving the right set of circumstances, the proper emotional environment, none of us are exempt from what tonight we would call even the most heinous of crimes against God. Solomon wrote in Proverbs 18 and verse 12, "Before destruction, the heart of a man is haughty, but humility goes before honor." 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 12, "Therefore let him who thinks he stand take heed lest he fall." Understand that there is an active and evil opponent in this world who is determined not just to destroy your soul, but to destroy your marriage, to destroy your children, and he will try to do it in any way that he deems that will be effective. And so don't make the mistake of being so infected with pride that you think that you are the exception to the rule, that somehow you are immune to that kind of sin, because I assure you that better people than you and me have fallen. A second failure is when we lack a genuine conviction. The primary battle in regard to immorality takes place in the mind. And no one understands that better than Satan. That whoever controls the mind, whoever controls the thinking, controls the actions. Now, we can't prevent wrong thoughts from just coming into our mind. That's called temptation. The question is, what do we do with those thoughts? Are they cultivated or are they captured? 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 5. Are they purged or are those thoughts promoted? Look back at the book of Genesis chapter 39. Look at Genesis chapter 39. I want us to notice the example, the marvelous example here of Joseph. Genesis chapter 39. And we're going to begin our reading in verse 7. Genesis chapter 39, beginning in verse 7. It came about after these events. Of course, he's been sold into slavery by his brothers. He has been purchased by Potiphar. He has gone to work in Potiphar's house, the chief of the bodyguard. And we find now, beginning in verse 7, that it came about after these things that his master's wife looked at desire with Joseph. And she said, "Lie with me," but he refused. And he said to his master's wife, "Behold with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. and he has put all that he owns in my charge. There is no one greater in this house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God? As she spoke to Joseph day after day, he did not listen to her to lie beside her or be with her. Do you see Joseph was no fool? That Joseph had taken time to think about the consequences of such a decision? That he was wise enough to calculate the cost that was connected to sacrificing his purity? I mean, you can fill in the blank, whatever famous star or athlete that you want to think about. Tiger Woods is the one that comes to my mind. He hasn't been the same, has he, since all of that came out that Thanksgiving a few years ago. I have to believe that Tiger wishes he could turn back the clock, that he would have stopped to calculate the cost of the decisions that he was making. Can you understand something of what would have plagued Joseph if he hadn't have made up his mind beforehand? That when Mrs. Potiphar began making her advances, he could have come up with a laundry list of justifications in his mind. After all, he grew up in a dysfunctional family. It was his brothers who hated him. His father misunderstood him. He lost his mom at a young age. He was sold by his own brothers into slavery. And in light of everything that he had endured to that point in his life, wasn't Joseph due a little bit of happiness? Didn't he have the right to at least some pleasure in life? And best of all, no one would have to know. No one would have to know. Do you see how this one decision in Joseph's life forever altered the course of his life moving forward? As a result of advertising in our day, I think we've become well aware of how well words and phrases can stick in our heads. Advertisers pay a lot of money, or are paid a lot of money, to come up with some kind of a slogan, that a few words that they hope will resonate in the mind of the American public, and that by remembering the slogan, that you will remember the product that the slogan represents. And so when I talk to you about the heartbeat of America, or the best a man can get, or nothing runs like a deer, or just do it, or always low prices, always, or fly the friendly skies, or have it your way, or driving excitement, or no rules, just right, or kid tested, mother approved, or you can't eat just one, or the real thing. We're familiar with most, if not all, of those products because of the slogan that resonates so much in our minds. But there's another slogan that dates back about 200 years back to the time when the United States Marine Corps was being formed. Great consideration was given to an appropriate motto. And they finally selected a Latin phrase that would, from that point forward, be ingrained in the mind of every Marine. Two powerful words that communicate a tremendous challenge for them and a magnificent lesson in terms of marriage. And those two words, of course, are Semper Fidelis, translated always faithful. Faithful not just when it's personally convenient. Faithful, not just when circumstances would guarantee our happiness. Not just some one-time act. Not an occasional experience. But always. And what I love most about that motto is that it describes for us a commitment that has absolutely nothing to do with the right to be happy and everything to do with a resolve to be responsible. When it comes to marriage, I can't think of two better words to be ingrained on our minds to understand that the time to think about the price tag attached to immorality is long before we're ever tempted to pay it. That like Joseph, the time to decide what you would do in a compromising situation is not when the compromising situation is on top of you, but rather when or prior to that, long before that ever takes place. That what circumstances would be detrimental to the vow, that you've already chosen that, you've already decided that before you ever arrive there. It was Goethe who said, to act is easy, to think is hard. Another flaw is when we fail to protect our eyes. The psalmist wrote in Psalm 101 in verse 3, I will walk within my house in the integrity of my heart. I will set no worthless thing before my eyes. Job in Job 31 in verse 1, I've made a covenant with my eyes. How then could I gaze upon a virgin? Again, where most of us are familiar with the story of David and Bathsheba. For the first 10 chapters of 2 Samuel, it seems as though David can do no wrong. He is never defeated in battle. He is never wrong in judgment. The enemies of Israel are subdued. The nation of Israel itself is unified. The capital of Jerusalem is finally secured. And the boundaries of the nation now expand from 6,000 square miles to 60,000 square miles. And then one event occurs in 2 Samuel chapter 11, and it forever alters David's life. Prior to that event, it seems the only thing David knows is triumph. After that event, it seems that all he knows is trouble. Now, obviously, we could track David's adultery with Bathsheba back to a point long before he stepped out on the palace roof that day. There were a number of mistakes that David made, but one of the most important had to do with his eyes. The first glimpse of the bathing Bathsheba, accidental. The second glare, intentional. David did what Paul said not to do. Paul said, make no provision for your lust. Romans 13 and verse 14, David made the provision. And we talked about the importance of a single decision in the life of Joseph. What about a single decision in the life of David? How did that one choice forever alter the course of David's life? We live in a day when it has become readily acceptable to leer at those of the opposite gender, to size them up from head to toe. And sadly, it's not just guys who are involved in that anymore. I can assure you that if that describes who you are, then you are walking on incredibly dangerous ground when it comes to the commitment that you've made not only to God but to your mate. The person who understands their vulnerability, the person who operates by a genuinely established set of convictions in the sensual realm is going to be extremely cautious about the images that they expose their eyes to. And I've come to believe that one of the most prevalent sins among Christians is one that is so easily hidden in the privacy of their home or some other place. And that is Christian men viewing pornography on the internet. Things have changed dramatically since I was a teenager. Now, with a click of a mouse, you bring it into your home. There, in hidden away from everyone's view, you can reach out and reach a world of the sensual, of the seductive, of the sinful. Understand, if you are one who is guilty of that, that sin has the power to destroy your marriage, to fracture your home, to devastate your kids. I've dealt with far too many men who, for whatever reason, refused to give it up and watched as their wife and his kids walked away. If that's something that you're involved in, understand that it has the power to consume you. It will eat your lunch spiritually. And that if you've tried to remove yourself from it, to separate yourself from it, and you have failed on numerous occasions, understand that the chances of you doing so by yourself are almost slim to none, that what is going to need to occur is for you to acknowledge and to confess it to someone who can hold you accountable. It may be your mate. It may be a friend, an elder, preacher. Someone who can help you to escape it. Because otherwise it will take you to a place of no return. Look at Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5, we're very familiar with what Jesus says in the first couple of these verses. Here in the Sermon on the Mount, he's describing how the importance of attitude, the importance of heart, of what transpires in the realm of the mind and the emotion. And he says in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 27 that you have heard it said that you shall not commit adultery, but I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. We're familiar with that. Jesus says you can be guilty of sensual sin that exists only in the realm of the mind, and one of the problems with sins of the mind is that it can be hidden from everyone's view. But the second point is one that tends to get lost. Look at the next two verses. Same context. He goes on to say this. He says, if your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you, for it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. If your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you, for it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. Jesus, using hyperbole, is saying you take whatever steps are necessary to maintain the purity of your mind and of your body, that you do whatever it takes to protect your eyes. I've got a friend of mine who occasionally travels on business, and he knows that this is an area of weakness. And so what he does is when he finds out where the hotel is, where he's going to be staying, he phones ahead. And he says to the management, he says, I want you to take the television out of the room. I want you to take it out. Sometimes they'll respond and they'll say, well, we can't remove it. It's bolted fast to the table. I don't know why they would bolt it fast. He says, well, then take all of the cords. No power, no connection to the cable. Take all of the cords from it. You say, wow, that's extreme. Yeah. Perhaps, but that's biblical. That's wise. That's exactly what Jesus says here. It's better. It's better to pluck your eye out and to go into heaven with one eye than to go into hell with both. Turn over to the book of Ephesians chapter 6. In Ephesians chapter 6, another flaw that leads to failure is when we get careless during what I call downtimes in the relationship. In Ephesians chapter 6 and beginning in verse 10, Ephesians 6 and verse 10, the Apostle Paul says this. He says, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Put on the full armor of God so that you will be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the full armor of God so that you will be able to resist in the evil day, and having done everything, to stand firm. Almost every incident of infidelity transpires because of some element of discontentment or disenchantment with the marriage. Things have changed from the way that they used to be. You don't enjoy each other's company like you once did. You don't communicate as you previously had. Even though you live in the same house, eat at the same table, sleep in the same bed, you might as well be 1,000 miles apart. Sometimes it's the addition of children into the home. At other times, the issue is a new job or problems with extended family. Or sometimes it's just a case of being too busy. But as a result of one or a combination of things, we allow ourselves to slowly and almost imperceptibly drift apart. That's a downtime. Or a downtime is when you've had a disagreement, an argument, a fight. And the ripple effects of that fight continue on for an extended period of time. That's a downtime. And with that subtle drifting apart comes a particular vulnerability. The befriending of someone other than your mate for the purpose of fulfilling some emotional or physical need. And I assure you that Satan not only is aware of that, but that he possesses the ability to put someone close to you. Understand, adultery doesn't begin in the bed. It begins in the heart. You begin talking to that person, and they just seem to understand you better. Nothing stirs the heart like flattery and acceptance and empathy, especially coming from someone of the opposite gender. You have a husband in a downtime who's convinced that his wife doesn't understand. In a downtime, you have a wife who is convinced that her husband doesn't appreciate her. And when you have that downtime, you have a couple that is incredibly vulnerable to enemy attack, to the schemes of Satan that Paul warns us about. And when we are in those extended downtimes, the comparison or the temptation is to compare our mate with someone else. And I assure you that if it's a downtime, that other person is likely to win the comparison. I've heard the question more times than I can count of someone who sat in my office and who asked the question of me, don't I have a right to be happy? They've gotten involved with someone else. They're about to walk out on their husband or their wife. They're about to leave their kids, and they have the audacity to ask me that question. Don't I have the right to be happy? I think if I hear that question one more time, I'm going to throw up in their face. Because what I want to say is, well, your happiness, what about the happiness of your mate? Don't they have a right to be happy? What about your children? Don't they have a right to be happy? Why does your right to be happy have to destroy their right to be happy? Don't misunderstand me. There's nothing wrong with wanting to be happy. There's something terribly wrong when we begin to rationalize that it's okay to violate the will of God and to be unfaithful to our mate in order to attain that happiness. If in your marriage you should encounter an extended downtime that's destroying your home, that's threatening your relationship, I urge you, I encourage you, get help from someone. A counselor, your elders, a preacher, a spiritually mature friend. As I mentioned this morning, I do premarital counseling, and one of the things that I emphasize this very point, if you see that you're having problems in your relationship, get some help with that. And I was talking to, I had performed the ceremony for this couple. They had moved away, and I was talking to the mom, and with this really distraught look on her face, she comes up to me, and I was asking her, well, how are they doing? And she says, well, they're in marriage counseling. She said they've been married 6 months. And they're in marriage counseling. And I looked at her and I said, that's great. And she, you know, what? What? They're doing what I counsel them to do. And today, they're doing fantastic. Believe it or not, sometimes preachers and preachers' wives need help. Bev and I had got to a place in our relationship where we had just swept some stuff under the rug. We hadn't dealt with things. And it finally all started to come to a head, not infidelity or anything like that, but just problems that we had never dealt with that was now beginning to dramatically affect our relationship. And it was at that point in time that, you know, I realized I need to swallow my male pride. We need help here. And with a little prodding from my wife as well. But understand this. The person to whom you are married is the most important human being in your world. And therefore, wouldn't it be wise to be willing to pay whatever price was necessary to making it work? Finally, when we improperly use lips and hands and feet, a person who is committed to being faithful to their mate will refuse to play those flirtatious junior high school games with those of the opposite gender. They'll understand what Solomon wrote in Proverbs 18 and verse 21, that death and life are in the power of the tongue, and those who love it will eat its fruit. Those who are seeking to live by the motto Semper Fidelis will exercise extreme caution in regard to the physical contact that they have with those of the opposite gender. I hope that you will not misunderstand this statement. It is one thing to hug someone. It is something entirely different to hug someone. A person who comprehends the seriousness of their vow will understand that there are times when you must not stand. You must run. That was Joseph, wasn't it? Genesis chapter 39, verse 12. She caught his garment, saying, "Lie with me," and he left his garment in her hand and fled. 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 18, flee immorality. That when you come face to face with a situation or a circumstance that you recognize to be a danger to the commitment you've made to God and to your mate, God's advice is you get out in a hurry, and you leave no forwarding address. It may come to a point where you have to have your feet demonstrating your resolve to keep your vow to your mate. The physical relationship between a husband and wife is one of the most wonderful gifts that God's given to man. But it becomes one of the greatest blights on society when humanity chooses to corrupt it. No matter what our culture may be saying, do not go through the stop sign that God has established in the realm of the sensual. I have had far too many personal experience with those who have inflicted incredible pain and hurt on others, their mate, their children, when their infidelity became known. Can we be forgiven of this sin? Absolutely. I love what Corrie Ten Boom says, that there is no pit so deep that God is not deeper still. His grace is more than abundant to reach us. And David certainly proves that, doesn't he? Can a marriage be healed even after infidelity? And the answer to that question is yes, I've seen it happen. It took a great deal of effort and mercy and grace and forgiveness. But remember this. You can't just click undo and erase the consequences. You can't just delete the emotional damage that's been done. There are consequences attached to that action that will linger throughout our lifetime. And thus the objective is to never find ourselves caught in that tender trap. Tonight, do you need to be a child of God? Maybe you need the forgiveness of God to obey the gospel of Jesus Christ, to be forgiven of your sins. As we bring our service to a close tonight, we offer you the opportunity to obey the gospel of Jesus, to be born into His family, to experience the depth and the riches of His grace and His love, and to become a part of His family.